Hey, everyone. I want to welcome you to today's episode of the HX Podcast. Today, I am truly honored to have a former colleague of mine, an old friend, join us. I've learned so much from him and his writing and his research and just about the newsletter business across the board. I want everyone to welcome from Stansberry Research, Dan Ferris. How you doing today, Dan?
Oh, very well, Enrique. It's great to see you again. Haven't seen you in a while, and it's great to be on the show.
Absolutely. Dan has been kind enough to have me on the Stansberry Investor Hour several times. His publications at Stansberry are Extreme Value and the Ferris Report, and we've always had a great time. And now this is my chance to reverse the tables and have you on my podcast.
Yeah.
So let's do this, Dan. You know, you and I have, we've met a dozen times. You know, we've hung out. We've done a ton of stuff together. I actually don't know that much about your background other than you came from very not Wall Street stuff and came into it. Maybe give us your story real quick and kind of bring us up through your tenure at Stansberry, because I'd love to hear the story.
Yeah, so not Wall Street is kind of an understatement, I'll tell you. So I was actually in my mid-30s in the 1990s and living a very bohemian lifestyle. I didn't own a car. Couldn't afford one, actually. And I was waiting tables, and I was a classical guitar major in college. So okay. I was playing guitar, usually at a place in Fells Point in Baltimore called Zamin Bean Cafe, which I believe is still there under different ownership.
And remind me, you're a Baltimore guy, right? You're from Baltimore originally?
Absolutely. Born and raised in Baltimore.
Okay, yep. Cool.
So here I was, and I had actually read, maybe in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, I had read some of the newsletters that were published by sort of the old school folks like Doug Casey and Adrian Day and folks like that. I can't remember. Jim Davidson, maybe one or two others. And then fast forward a little bit through the story here so it doesn't get too long. I knew a gal who lived across the street from me who got a job with the publisher of these newsletters called Agora. Okay. And she brought some of them home with her. And I was like, hey, I used to subscribe to this stuff. I know who these people are. I know all this stuff. And I started reading some of it. And I thought, you know what? I think I could do research at least as good at this. And I had already done a little bit of research into like gold stocks and gold stock funds to try to figure out which ones kind of had the most torque in them.
Can I stop you for a second right there, though? Because this is
sure.
This is interesting to me.
Yeah.
You were waiting tables.
Yep.
You're playing guitar.
Yep.
How the hell did you get interested in gold stocks? It just doesn't like I don't necessarily see the connection there. What kind of sparked that interest?
I'll tell you, the connection came from It actually came through Doug Casey because he had talked about all this financial stuff in his book, Crisis Investing for the Rest of the 90s. Now, I had exposure to that book through the old laissez-faire book catalog because I'm a sort of libertarian-oriented guy from way back.
Got it. Okay, now it's tying together a little bit, yeah.
There you go. So that was the connection. That's how we got from like reading Ayn Rand and whoever else to finance. And when I saw these newsletters that my friend had brought home, I thought, you know, I remember sitting in her kitchen table saying, you know, I can do this. I think I can do research like this. So a little time went by and I wrote a letter to Bill Bonner, the guy who founded this company that was publishing all these letters. And I got lucky because his secretary later told me that she throws all these things in the garbage because he doesn't want to see like resumes and cover letters by people with finance degrees and stuff, right? So I didn't have a finance degree. I had a music degree. And I just had these ideas. I said, you know, I think I could do this. And literally, he said, okay, call this guy up and get him in here. We did not talk for 10 full minutes.
Okay.
And he's just looking at the little, you know, sort of, I gave him a one page, you know, I've done this, I've done that kind of a thing, almost like a resume. And he said, well, and then he looks at me, he's sitting at his desk, he says, well, you can work here. That's no problem. He said, but if, you know, we don't get along, maybe we'll part friends after 6 months or so. Okay. Let's just make that deal. And that was.
Okay.
He said that in November of 1997. I started December 8th, 1997, and then of course I wound up working for Porter Stansberry, and he split off from the company, and it's a whole separate deal now. So really never change jobs.
I'm curious in the story.
Yeah.
What was it? Because I know you. I think you're fucking awesome. Like, I know what you are now, you know, and have
you
been probably
really
for a
smart,
long time.
Enrique.
Yeah. But in 1997, you're, again, completely no background on this. You sent him a one-pager. What did he read in there? Do you think that, just because I'm listening to your version of the story, what was it in there that all of a sudden he just decided to take you on? I got to imagine he's getting hundreds of resumes. You know, what was the driver of it?
Excellent question. You, of all people, you will appreciate this, having been in the subscription business here and being still in it now. So I knew nothing about, you know, writing newsletters or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But my little one pager had a couple of the elements that this entire thing is based on.
Okay.
One of them being like testimonials, because I said, okay, if you contact this person that I work for, she will say good things about me. If you contact this person that I work for, they will say this about me. And I think I did three of those, you know, and I put myself into the sort of milieu of all the libertarian financial, you know, crossroad that we discussed a moment ago, right? So I had that. I had the testimonials, right? So I was telling the reader all the stuff he wanted to hear, right?
Right.
People will say good things about me, and I know about this stuff. So he was like, well, he's worth talking to, because, you know, it was totally different. It wasn't like a finance resume or anything.
Yeah. No, but I mean, yeah. I'll tell you, that's one of the things I learned, my background with this. And, you know, but I think we've talked about this, but when Whitney told me he was going to join Porter and found Empire, he said investment newsletters. And I'm like penny stocks? Like, what the hell are you talking about? There's such a huge divide between the professional investors and the newsletter writers, that they're two worlds that are related, but they're very, very different. And I say that because I work very hard to bridge those. That's what Empire was about. That's what HX is about, trying to bring the research and knowledge from those you know, people that have managed billions like me, and put it in language that ordinary people can understand. But I think Bill might have looked at yours and said, this guy obviously has the gusto, the initiative, but he's also speaking in normal language. And I think that's a really big issue to communicate.
Huge.
And I was blown away. Blown away with Stansberry. By the way, just so you know, on this bookshelf, which is back there on the very top, there's a statue of Ronald Reagan, there's a bust of Teddy Roosevelt, and in between the two is Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead. It's a little Easter egg up in the corner. Okay, so you joined Porter in, when did you hook up with Porter?
Okay, so started with Bill in December 97, started with Porter September of 2000. Yes.
Got it. So for the people listening here, explain your franchise, kind of what your goal is or how you frame it. I just did it with ours. You know, my goal is to take access and knowledge that is normally reserved for managing billions of dollars and translate it into actionable ideas and, you know, sort of investment guidelines for regular people, like, you know, like people where I came from, people where you came from. If you go through your franchise, how do you think about it when you think about it sort of from the top down?
So at this point, of course, I write these two different newsletters. But before we get to that, overall, here's the thing. You got to understand, me, I'm sort of a subset of what Porter has done, what Porter Stansberry has done. He came in at a time when there were a lot of those like penny stock guys, like, pushing stocks they owned and unloading them on readers and all kinds of stuff. And he looked at the sort of over the top promotional style and the content. And he just thought, well, okay, look, you want to crow about what you're doing. You want to be proud of it. And you want to make all the claims and be passionate about it and tell the world about it. I get the promotional side, but can't we just have real research? Can't we just away with all these promoters and people and do real research? So, you know, then he found people he thought could do that. And at first he thought I was the guy who might help him do a bunch of technology research. Long story short, that didn't really work out. So then Porter told me, I want you to write a newsletter called Extreme Value. And, you know, the whole conversation didn't take 30 seconds. And he said, this is what we're going to do. And we're going to charge a lot for it, but you're going to do detailed bottom-up value research. And we had a laugh about it because at the time Porter was reading, you know, Telecosm and Microcosm, these books by George Gilder and stuff.
George Gilder.
And we had a laugh about the extreme value idea. We thought, you know, we'd write a book called Shitcosm because it would be these beaten down value plays and things, which we did start out with some of those. We started out with some net nets Gateway was
okay.
pretty quick double when it was a net. And I remember I called the CFO of Gateway and I said, do you think you're really going to still have $1 billion cash on the balance sheet by the end of this year? And that was in March, and it was $700 million market cap, no debt. I was like, okay. And he said, yeah, I really do, because, you know, cash flow isn't our problem, et cetera, et cetera. So it doubled pretty quickly. And Circuit City did the same thing. That was cool. But
yeah, I want to pause right there too, because I remember that moment in time post the internet bubble, as well as post the financial crisis, there mm-hmm. were certainly quite a few companies that were trading below net cash.
Lots of
you know, the problem was a bunch of them were still burning so much cash, it didn't really matter.
Yes.
But it's kind of I never made that connection until you just said it right now, that, you know, when you get into a financial crisis, you inevitably end up with these companies trading below net cash. Whether you should buy them or not is a whole nother question, but they rear their heads during those periods. So
absolutely. So anyway, we eventually evolved into what I believe most people would refer to as a GARP strategy. It's really okay. what we would call an expectations, price implied expectation strategy. And that came about from a book by Michael Mauboussin and Alfred Rappaport called Expectations Investing. I basically mm-hmm. sent this book to the analyst I work with, Mike Barrett, who yep. is better than me at all of this stuff. He joined us about 10 years into Extreme Value in 2010. And I sent him this book, and then he said, yep, we're doing this. And he full-blown put this model together, and that's what we do on every stock now. But okay. the basic idea is it flips discounted cash flow on its head, right? So discounted cash flow is like you plug in all these future projections of revenues and cash flows and profit margins and things, and then you apply this discount factor, and it gives you a present value.
Yep.
It never made me comfortable because it's a prediction.
Yeah.
You're predicting these things. And I was like, well, you know, if you do some kind of a range of these values to really admit that you don't know what the future is going to be,
yeah, yeah.
it's going to be unwieldily wide, put it that way. So then we found expectations investing, which basically says to get to the current market value, what do you got to plug into the model?
Yeah.
So right now, you know, for certain stocks, like you got to believe there's like zero growth in them. And we don't think okay. there's zero growth necessarily. Or,
okay.
you know, there's a lot less than consensus growth in some really good company like Costco or something. So that's what we're doing now. And the idea is just good fundamental-based bottom-up research applied one stock at a time.
Yeah, you and I have worked together and we've talked a lot, but we usually talk topically. We talk about like what's going on right now. We haven't really talked strategy right. and all that. So I think that's really interesting. Well, so let me ask you this, and I think you're one of the best at this, although I'm going to put you on the spot here. When I first read the Stansberry stuff, so Whitney says to me, I'm going to go do newsletters. And I did what you mentioned before. I was like, oh, penny stocks, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, no. Porter does real work. It's real, all this. And I read the letters and there were two things that stood out. Okay. Number two mm-hmm. was, I was like, these are real ideas. This is a good, solid idea. The kind of idea I might get involved in, you know, neither here nor there. The ideas were solid, you know, very good. It really just depends on the style, okay? So that per style, they fit very well. But the thing that blew me away, absolutely blew me away, was that you and Steve and Shug and Porter, there was this ability to take complex subjects about economics and about investing in general and boil them down into a narrative that someone could understand. Because as I understood later, professional investors, I feel like they come up with an idea and then they do hours, if not hundreds of hours, if not thousands of hours of work on detail, that's all false precision. Like it's just all this like, you know, attempting to figure out stuff.
It absolutely is.
They're yeah. justifying their fees. But when I read the higher level kind of guidelines, precepts, mantras, ideas that you guys put forth, I was like, shit, man, I wish half these professional money managers would actually just read this and do these 10 things and stuff like that. So I'm going to ask you, and I don't know that you have these ready. If you were to go through in your worldview about investing, et cetera, and you were to pick mm-hmm. 3, 5, 10 precepts that you think are the major guidelines, that if there's one person that listens to this and has never heard of you, never read your stuff, they walk away and say, oh, those were the 5 things he said I should focus on when I'm looking at an mm-hmm. investment. What would you say those 5 things are? And we can take them sort of one by one.
There's positives and negatives.
Okay.
In the negative, learn to understand and recognize and then control for risk in your portfolio.
Okay.
Risk, risk, risk. Understand what it is, what it means. Okay.
Define risk. When you say risk, what are you saying?
The likelihood of a permanent loss.
Okay.
The likelihood of a permanent impairment to some investment in your portfolio.
Got it.
Money that's gone and not coming back.
Got it. So if I were to take a look, for instance, at 2 stocks, we'll do 3. Well, I'll kind of do this. One of them's a big growth idea, but it's burning cash and they've got financing needs. The other one is a relatively stable, is Costco, okay, as an example. I guess right. You're saying the first thing you should do is look at those 2 ideas and say, if this goes wrong, how wrong can it go? And obviously with Costco, yeah, I guess Costco could go bankrupt in some decade or something. Very unlikely.
I mean,
so define your downside in the individual stock. Is that another way to say what you're saying?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Define the downside in the individual stock. And you can do a lot by looking at certain industries.
Okay.
Right? Is it mining? Is it a highly capital intensive, highly cyclical, risky industry that requires massive amounts of upfront capital before you get a penny of revenue, and you employ an army of unionized employees? I mean, you can, in the negative, do away with swaths of risk. There are risks that you can just wipe off the table and say, I'll never take that risk.
I think you could also, I'm not advising this because you got to look at the return side in a second. I mean, if you just said, I'm not going to mm-hmm. do companies with debt or not going to do companies that have positive free cash flow or positive, or just even go to EBITDA, you just knocked out 30% of company. I mean,
take out debt,
you knock out 80. You know, 80, we'll put some, but you can just like, right there, take out whether you want. You may not want to take out those risks. Okay, define your risk. What's the positive side of that then?
An easy way for me to state the positive side is a screen that helps us establish our universe in extreme value. So we want to know free cash flow, margins, the history of in the last 5 to 10 years. Usually last 5 is enough, because 10, the company might have been completely different. So several years, any number of years you like, of free cash flow, margins. We want to see the balance sheet, what it is now, how it's developed. And I want to look at what they've done with some of this free cash flow. I want to look at the history of what we might call shareholder rewards.
Okay.
Right? Did they buy back stock? Like net purchases of stock, you know, not just issuing lots of it and buying it back. And, you know, have they paid dividends? Because dividends, one of the good things about dividends is it takes the money out of their pockets so that they can't do mischief with it.
So
and
let
then
me.
Return metrics is the 5th one.
I'm going to not dumb it down, but kind of make it even simpler. So look at the risk. You know, what is the chance of permanent impairment of capital? Then you say these metrics that you then screen by. There specific metrics you're looking for. What are those specific metrics? Are there 2 of them, 4 of them, 5 of them? What are the metrics that you're looking for?
Let's see, I could break it down, I guess. Free cash flow is a single metric, and then you're looking for how consistent. Generally speaking, consistency is what we're looking for, because that's more rare than the odd cyclical performance, right?
Okay, so consistency of operating performance
right.
being defined as margin and cash flow. Is that a good way to say it? Paraphrase? That,
good enough, yes, perfect.
Got it.
And the consistency is important because we mentioned Costco a second ago. Consistently net margin of like 1.5%, right?
Yeah.
Like 1.5%, who cares? Well, we care because then we look into why they do things the way they do. And, you know, the markup is always 15% and the margins are always like operating 3, net 1.5, et cetera. So we understand why they're
doing it. Well, it's also 1.5% on like $100 billion. So.
Yeah, that's right.
That number counts too.
Yep, it does. And so, and you know, we understand what they're doing, you know, passing all the savings along, et cetera, the whole thing, you know, the 4,000 SKUs instead of like 150,000 at Walmart, the whole model then comes into play. But just those metrics, and we do tend to look for margins. It would be like gross operating pre-tax and net.
Got it. But so let's come back to this. This all comes into a topic that we've written about a lot, which is I call the setup. And that is the idea that often 90% of your investment outcome is decided the day you buy the stock. You know, it's like all the dice are thrown, okay?
Yep.
And so it sounds like you all, as everyone should, spend a lot of time on the setup. And your setup in particular that you're looking for in your strategy, you're defining the potential impairment of capital, which I'm guessing you have a limit to how much you're willing to accept. And then you're looking for a group of consistency in operating metrics along with sort of absolute levels of operating metrics. So by definition, you are refining your entire universe into a, I will say, lower risk, greater consistency, sort of evergreen type portfolio, high quality portfolio. Is that a good way to characterize that process?
It is. And for people who know factors, we were doing quality factor before it was cool. So, you know. Enrique, let me tell you something.
Yeah.
In the newsletter business, that, what we just said, looking for quality based on real business metrics that, you know, real business owners would want to see, actually. At the time that Porter started his business, that was a big deal. Like saying, no, we're not going to recommend all this speculative garbage. Because, you know, once in a great while, one in a thousand of these companies goes 10 for one or 100 to one or whatever. We're not going to do this. We're going to focus on real businesses. That alone was a big deal in the year 2000.
You know, Porter once said to me, he goes, just don't blow the reader up, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there's something to be said for that. If you have a long enough time frame, and I'm not being an asshole and saying, yeah, if we got 30 years, you know, if you have a long enough perspective and you pick businesses the right way, as long as you manage that downside, you're going to get paid. This is a crazy analysis. I just wrote it up. It's going to come out this week in HX Daily. I don't mean to digress, but this blew me away. If you would have bought the four biggest internet stocks, pure play internet stocks of the internet bubble were AOL, Yahoo, Amazon, and eBay. Those were the four biggest by market cap. Mm-hmm. Do you realize, had you bought those at the top, so all you did was you said, I'm going to take the biggest. You bought them at the top. You have like a 35% IRR because AOL, because of Time Warner, you actually ended up, you know, I don't know, breaking even. Yahoo, because of Alibaba, you end up making money from the top. And Amazon, eBay was at 5 and now it's at 50. And Amazon was at, I don't know, $3 and now it's at 170 or something. So my point is about long-term time and perspective. And that just surprised me. So now we've defined the universe. This is your fishing hole. What then are you looking to identify for the names that you are going to step out on and say, we think you should take your hard-earned money, your savings, and put it into this name? What is that characteristic that's going to make you step forward with the recommendation?
Well, the ideal thing actually would be a company that is one of the dominant players in its industry.
Okay.
You know, it got big for a reason. Like when a company scales up, there's almost no substitute for size as a competitive advantage. Put it that way.
Absolutely.
You know how it is. It's just the dynamics of business. You know, spreading more revenue over the same size cost base is like free money just dropping out of the sky, right?
I've made this point, and I just want to share this real quick because I think you know these numbers. If you took the entire Russell 2000, it has less market cap and net income than Apple by itself.
Yep.
And everyone's complaining. So I've been like, who gives a shit what the Russell 2000 does? Like, are there real companies? It's a real part of the economy. Like, but you know, it's smaller than Apple. But my point has been, you know, it's not surprising that whether the Mag 7 are in a bubble or not, we can leave that aside.
Yeah.
These companies do much better than these tiny companies that are affected by inputs and interest rates and all these other things because they're all subscale relative to these major guys. So size has an advantage without a doubt.
Absolutely. I would go farther. I would say it may be the ultimate advantage. I'm not sure that's always true, but it may be the ultimate advantage.
Got it. So you're looking for scale. You're looking for dominance in their industry. What else would you look for?
From there, it tends to be sort of a one at a time kind of a thing. Like If it's in an industry, for example, where you make highly engineered kind of products, maybe like in the dental industry or, you know, a company that serves a lot of different industries and makes some kind of highly engineered widget or another. I'm trying to keep this as general as possible.
On the individual stock then, so you're looking for, you know, a well situated competitively with scale. And then is it really that you're sort of looking for individual product catalyst, individual dynamics that will kind of drive that in the intermediate to long term?
I'm glad you asked about catalysts. Certainly, if we believe we've found one, that's great, but I don't require them. I don't think we often get to know. That's why I figure if we insist on a business of a certain quality, we'll say, we've been talking about that.
It makes its own catalysts.
Right. In fact, whatever caused it to fall in price may even provide the catalyst for the return because, oh, lo and behold, they'll get over their problem. Their problems are all generally manageable. I learned a lot from a short seller once who said, you know, if there are a lot of little niggling problems, that's manageable. Management can take care of that. But if it's one bullet to the brain, be careful. You know, so I look for that bullet to the brain and I want to make sure it's not there. Like, for example, I'll never buy a pharmacy benefit manager ever because the bullet to the brain there is simply that this business shouldn't exist. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. It's a crazy thing. These middlemen exist purportedly to get better pricing on drugs, but they don't do that. Know, they cost you
money. By the very fact that they exist. So you start by eliminating. It sounds like your process. You're eliminating stocks that have a kill shot risk. You're eliminating companies that aren't high enough quality. Then you're looking for dominant or very well-positioned businesses and that can accrue value through time. That's the structure of the portfolio. So let me ask you this. One of the things I got from you guys, you know, is we talk about a couple ideas that are kind of just maxims that we use, okay? And one of the maxims I say is do the work. Go out, read about the company, read the research. You know, not that you're necessarily going to be able to drive more value than like the 1,000 analysts that look at it. But when you know what you're doing, you have more confidence. You're going to have more ability. You're just going out and actually doing the research because it blows me away with stocks. I always tell the story. You take someone as a dental practice and I go, Mike, I want you to invest in my dental practice. The guy has 7,000 questions. But I go, Mike, I got this AI stock from China. And then the guy's all of a sudden like, oh, sure, here's my $10,000 or something like that. But so we say do the work. We say plan the trade and trade the plan. That doesn't necessarily have to do with trading, by the way. That can be for investing where that also can work. And the third one, which again, it doesn't have to do with trading, is trade a lot or don't trade at all. Decide what kind of investment you're making, okay? So to me, these three things just by themselves, if you just adhere to those, whatever strategy you're doing, you're gonna have a greater chance of success. What would you put into that category as kind of guiding principles that you think investors should take into account when they're looking at whatever portfolio it is, trading or investing?
Well, let's see. The biggest mistake I think people make is not knowing when they're going to get out.
Okay.
Right? We do all this selection work and all this screening and qualification and things, but then there's another end to this. Like if you don't sell and you're up 10x, you know, you can be down 5x before you know it or down, you know, to a 5x return.
Yeah, 50%.
Before you know it. Yeah, right, 50%. So you have to know when you're going to sell. And that's really, it turns out that's really hard. Especially if you are a long-term investor who wants to hold businesses for a long time because you think they're good businesses and they're going to compound your capital at a high rate. So, you know, when do you sell one of those, right?
That is plan the trade. And more importantly, plan the trade is enough people don't do it. The one that's a son of a bitch is trade the plan because inevitably, whether it's on the downside or the upside, I actually think sell high is much harder than buy low, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. I would say, Enrique, I would say sell, period, is harder than buy.
Yeah.
Buying is fun. It's exciting. I'm going to make money.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we've interviewed like, I don't know how, you know, a couple of hundred traders, including some of the Market Wizards folks, you know, yourself among them on the Stansberry Investor Hour. And we always, and I mean every single time, we wind up in the same place where we say, eventually somebody kind of usually blurts out as an afterthought, but, you know, trade selection isn't really the big deal. The thing that, you know, determines what you're going to do is like your position sizing and your stops you know, when you exit and all the money management stuff.
It's the plan and sticking to it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we're aligned there. So one of these is, I mean, you're basically saying come up with a good plan and stick to it, you know, is
absolutely
that. And what other big mistake? Because I guess mine, you know, I actually hadn't thought about it till this podcast. My like mottos or mantras have a lot to do with the most common mistakes, right? Like trade a lot or don't trade at all. That actually comes from a negative, because what happens is people go in and they say, oh, I'm a long-term investor. And then the stock trades off 15% and they go, oh, I got to risk manage, you know, and then now you're in the middle. You don't want to be in the middle. Either you're trading or you're holding. When you're in the middle, like that's where you get killed. It's in the middle of the battlefield, you know.
They do the other thing too, don't they? They say I'm just in this for a trade, and then they're down 25%. They say I'm a long term investor.
So. No, I'm a long term. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I'm not saying those can't be right because things can change. But sure. I'm going to tell you, the vast majority of the time, I'll even say this. I appreciate that. If you ever, as an investor, said, I'm going to do this as a trade and it goes against you, and you say, now I'm a long-term holder, okay? Or if you ever, as a long-term holder, have it go against you and say to yourself, well, I have to risk manage, I'm going to say two things. Number one, you made a mistake going into it. You got to come up with a better plan next time. Number two, I'm going to tell you 9 times out of 10, you shouldn't do what you're about to do next. You know, you should stick with that original instinct, because it's probably going to be it was probably the right one to begin with. So
right. That second one is really important. 9 times out of 10, you're not going to do it right. Plus, the other thing that all those traders wind up saying is, I make money on less than half my trades. Like, so much for the selection process, huh? It's just
right.
You know. So yeah.
Although I'll tell you, it, you know, there so in our trading, and we got a verified track record of this in HX Trader, which is the descendant of Empire Elite Trader, we've made money in 75% of our trades, which is, I think, that if you do the right kind of work picking the setup and then also have the plan, you can really optimize. Now, that strategy is not there to make you 10 times your money. That one's there to grind out returns. Okay, so what other two other mistakes that you think investors commonly make that you would, you know, you would recommend or give some advice to on how to avoid?
Let's see, two others. Well, yeah, I guess we're saying not having a plan, then not trading it. And two others, I don't know. Those big ones are just like, they take up a lot of territory, don't they? But right, I would say also, maybe it's an offshoot of the mistakes that we already talked about, but you really have to know yourself. Like, in order to get to all this plan and everything, you have to understand that you're a human being and you're going to have a certain risk tolerance and you're going to have a certain ability to handle all the things that inevitably come up. And most people overestimate that, right? They say, I'm very risk tolerant. No problem. I can hold when I'm 25% down. And, you know, most people really can't. So knowing yourself is really hard, but it's really essential. And the better you know yourself, the better you'll do over time, I think. We human beings, we have a poor ability to assess our emotional state at some future point under some circumstances. Even if you can imagine the exact scenario, you're probably not as good as at understanding what your future emotional state will be and what you'll be willing to do about it as you think.
Know yourself as an investor, would you say?
Yeah, know yourself and be conservative. Be realistic about it, because, you know, even when you say you know yourself, you don't know yourself as well as you think, because you're a human being, you know? So it's
tough. We literally, in the HX Daily today, we wrote a note which said, know why you're investing. Understand why you're investing. Understand what your goals are, what kind of investor you are, because I think that there's so many things in life, actually, that we just do, but we never actually take a step back and say, why am I doing this? And why am I doing it the way I am and all that? And you know, and then a lot of mistakes are made. So I'm actually going to go to this last thing, because when I think of you, when one word comes to mind, other than dead sexy. I guess that's two words. But one word comes to mind is an investor. we're allowed to be funny like that on this podcast, yeah, okay?
And that is funny.
I think, yeah, Silver Fox, there you go. I think of value is the first word that comes to mind when I think of Dan Ferris. What role does value play for you? Should it play for investors? I mean, your name is just attached to it. I mean, extreme value. It's like, right. You know, what's your take on value and what role it should play?
So actually, I have a whole other newsletter that's not a value letter. It's based on what I call macro trends and micro trends. You know, if, for example—
Is that the Ferris Report or—
Yeah, that's the Ferris Report. And for example, I've picked three home builder stocks, which I'm perfectly willing to share because they're like three big ones. Because I don't think once you get one of these things right, you don't need to go down the quality trail. You can just get the beta. You can, you know, buy the top names. I feel the same way about oil and gas. You know, you can just buy the good names and you're good. So, you know, I recommended like D.R. Horton and Pulte and Lennar. Just, you know, good large U.S. home builders, the three biggest, I believe, at this point, because I think the fundamentals there are very good. We all know there's a deficit of supply, even with interest rates where they are, and just reasonable household formation. Nothing off the charts will keep those fundamentals in place for some time.
We've been talking a lot about recently also in HX Daily about trends. And that, you know, I think it's very common for people to look at trends well-established. Actually, almost all this week, this is all I wrote about. It's funny you say this, is you look at a trend and you go, well, that trend's already happened, whether it's the GLP-1s, whether it's home building, et cetera. But people forget that for a stock to go up tenfold, it has to go up twofold and fivefold and sixfold and eightfold first.
Right.
So I think that there are these mega trends. And one note I actually put was the GLP-1 stocks, which are these weight loss. So, you know, look, everyone knows what they are, Novo Nordisk and Lilly. Mm-hmm. You know, the charts all look like this and then at the end go like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I actually said that what you should do, that is a big trend, just dollar cost average into that trend if they look ballistic or something like that. So so there is something to be said for trend following, you know, and that one's not so value oriented. So, okay, so you're looking for big trends. But then if you were to say when investors think about value, for you, is value more of a risk management technique? It sounds a little bit like it from what we spoke about before. Or how do you look at value?
I look at value as relative to my expectations, relative to my understanding of a business and my expectations for it.
Okay.
You can't just say, I'm only going to buy something that's dirt cheap and, you know, 10 times earnings or something like that. You just can't do that. That's not a good idea. And overall, of course, what do we really want to do? We want to pay something like a reasonable price for a business that's going to grow for a long time. Not a whole lot real soon. Yeah. Because I've seen some work recently that says, you know, 20% CAGRs almost never last 5 years or more. You know, it's like year four, year five, boom, you're done with that, you know? So what we want is something that can go, you know, mid or even low sometimes, single digit growth for a long time. And that's where you'll get the compounding.
You've surprised me today, Dan. Again, you and I haven't spoken about this stuff before. I have you in this value bucket, but you bring up a great point. I want to take this and we're going to end on this.
Okay.
I always, when people talk about Warren Buffett and people say Warren Buffett's the greatest value investor in history and stuff. And I say, no. I said, well, first off, a stock never went up because it was cheap. Okay. Ever. I go, when Warren Buffett bought Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola didn't go up 50-fold. Because Coca-Cola was trading at 10 times, 15 times earnings, whatever he bought it at. Coca-Cola went up 50-fold because they went from making $100 million of profit to $10 billion of profit. Period, end of story. Mm-hmm. All the money that Warren Buffett has made was, and maybe this speaks to your style, is he bought things at reasonable prices, but everything that went up then went up because it grew earnings, whether it's his private businesses, See's Candies, Geico, whether it's Apple, you know, none of these went up because they were cheap. He got in at a price that he wasn't going to get burnt. And then they just had good, strong, consistent growth. Again, right. Coca-Cola, American Express, you know, things like that. So, okay, so I see you. I see you as Warren Buffett's successor right here. Here we go.
There we go. Yeah. I would qualify that in one way, and I think Buffett might too, which is that they were able to reinvest enough at a reasonably good return, right? Let's stick that in there too, because
sustainability of growth, right. I guess.
Yeah,
maybe.
There we go. Yeah.
Great. Well, Dan, this has been great. I mean, I look forward to getting on the Stansberry Investor Hour again. When we get on there, it's always about talking about what's happening at the moment and all this.
Sure.
But I really like this format too. And by the way, again, you and I have hung out a bunch. I know so much more about what makes you tick now, you know, in terms of the investor. It's really helpful for me. So everyone, you can follow Dan. What's your Twitter handle? Because I follow you, but I don't know off the top of my head.
At dferris1961.
Okay, at dferris1961. Check him out. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with Stansberry Investment Research. They've got a free daily product, Daily Wealth, that you can sign up for. Great products. Get on the mailing list. It's great stuff. And Dan, you know, I want to thank you. You've actually been a mentor in this business to me. You know, I came out of a lot of investing and a lot of research and very little of newsletter writing. And I think that the whole team at Stansberry, Porter, Shug, yourself, you know, there's so much of what I do day to day. You know, I'm talking to your partner in crime, Corey McLaughlin, all the time about saying, hey, can I use this idea in one of my newsletters? So I want to thank you for your support and mentorship.
Oh, thank you.
And thank everyone for joining us here on the HX Podcast. And we'll see y'all again soon.
The HX Podcast is a production of Underground Media, produced by Matt Rocker and Enrique Abeda. Please rate, review, and follow the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can follow on X and YouTube at HX_research and get more information on our newsletters at daily.hxresearch.net. This podcast is for entertainment and informational purposes only and is not a substitute for specific individualized financial advice. You understand that you are using any and all information at your own risk. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.